It's Sal Capaccio.
Sal Capaccio. Sal Capaccio. Sal Capaccio. Sal Capaccio. Sal Capaccio. Sal Capaccio. Sal Capaccio.
On WGR.
A man that needs no introduction, even though technically he did just get an introduction. Sal Capaccio joining me here on the Wester Hotline. Sal, I've started today's show with a topic around college football, and I've kind of asked all my guests this morning about it, and I'd like to ask you the Tim Tebow situation. If you didn't hear it, I assume you at least saw some things on Twitter about it. What are your thoughts about Tim Tebow's comments? I was really disappointed, Sal. Tim Tebow is someone that, as a younger athlete, I looked up to a lot. He was one of my favorite players growing up. And I thought they were kind of irresponsible, some of the comments that he made on First Take. I understand the show that he's on. I understand his role on that show. But I still was disappointed. I was interested in your thoughts on the take as a whole. I don't need you to go into giving me solutions about what the NCAA is going to do, but I was really interested in your opinion on some of the things he said yesterday.
First of all, good afternoon. Just turned noon. And can you refresh me? He just basically said college athletes should not be paid, correct?
They should not be paid based on his experiences in college football. And he basically said, I have a pretty good leg to stand on here in my experience. I never wanted to be paid. He said something along the lines of, and when I was in college, my jersey was one of the third most popular jerseys sold, like right behind LeBron and somebody else. And he's like, and I never wanted a dime from that. And it was just, it was, you know, what do you mean you never wanted a dime from that? Like, it was just a very weird way of expressing a very polarized opinion,
I mean, well, that's you. I mean, yeah. maybe he didn't want a dime from it. That's fine. It does not mean at all that he's not worth getting paid for it, or anybody else isn't worth getting paid for it, or shouldn't be paid for it. Whatever he wants, he doesn't have to take it. He could, if they had a rule when Tim Tebow was at Florida, that he could make money and profit off his jersey being sold, he could donate that money if he doesn't want it. You know what I mean? Just because he doesn't want it doesn't mean that's the way it should be for everyone. There's a right way and a wrong way to do this, and everybody can decide themselves if they kind of want to be a part of that or not want to be a part of that once they do this. And eventually it's going to happen in some way, shape, or form. It's going to. We're at the tipping point, I think, now. We've been there for a little while, and it's finally, I think, starting to go towards that side of some sort of monetary payment, whether that's for likenesses mm-hmm. and jerseys or outright stipends or things like that. A bit odd, but I don't think Tim Tebow really actually had the same college experience
Correct.
Than most kids. And
Correct.
I think that's why people are upset at him. And I agree with that. And he was a very popular guy. He's one of the greatest college players ever.
Mm-hmm.
And his jersey is super popular. And it is still super popular, by the way. But that doesn't mean that it's the same thing for everybody.
Yeah, that's right, Sal. And I think the one thing is, I think there are solutions, and the problem becomes when players with the level of recognition that like a Tim Tebow has comes out without really, I just didn't think there was a lot of nuance to what he was saying. Really, what it was at the end of the day was, hey, I'm Tim Tebow. If I don't want to be paid, no one should want to be paid. And that's what's so great about college football. And that's why everyone loves college football more than the NFL, because there's no money in it. And I don't know. It's just, it was a weird thing for me to watch and listen to yesterday. And hearing mostly everyone I've asked and talked to us about, Sal, all kind of have the same response to it, which I think is also unique.
Yeah, and he's being called out by some of his own colleagues at ESPN and other people who've basically, you know, played college football or are prominent in the media, people like that. So it's polarizing, but I think Tim Tebow in a lot of ways has been polarizing mm-hmm. ever since he, you know, and not necessarily in a negative way. You know, many people love him for a lot of great reasons, but he's always been an interesting figure in a lot of different ways.
All right, Sal, let's steer our attention back to the Bills here. I got a really good opportunity this week. I was actually kind of mentioning this on the radio earlier. You're not here. You're on the sidelines, so I assume it's very similar for you. We get to watch the game just like we do here in the studio, but it's very hard to take away some really of the finer details until you know we get to sit down, really watch the All-22, watch Game Pass, watch it a few times over, and pick things up. I feel very differently about the first half after watching it two or three times, once from the normal broadcast angle and then from the All-22, than I was Sunday last week after I watched the first half live. And one of the reasons was the four turnovers really clouded everything that I thought about that first half. Yet they were still only down 6-0 at the end of the half there. But what did you take away from the Bills offense? I remember having this conversation with you during the preseason after the first 2 weeks we saw Brian Daboll throw the ball with regularity, and neither of us were really willing to say, well, this is a trend that we should really watch for. But it turns out 17 straight times they drop back, Sal, to start that game. Were you surprised at that week one they came out the way that they did, 17 straight dropbacks to start the game?
Of course. I mean, who wouldn't be surprised at that many, right? I mean, am I surprised they came out throwing the football? No. I was the one for 2 weeks who said, you need to attack their corners. Like, that's how you beat this team. Just spread them out and throw the football, and I'd love to see them do that. And if they do that, that's a sign that they have confidence that they can win the game that way. So I expected them to come out and throw the football. I did not expect them to come out and throw the ball at the frequency at which they did, of course. But they did. And I think it goes back to everything we've seen since the offseason started, which is, look, Josh Allen's our quarterback. We drafted him 7th overall, and there's a reason for that. And we're not gonna baby him, as I've been saying for a while now. It's a theme I've been saying, and people are probably sick of me hearing me say that, but it's true. That's kind of the way they've approached him. And that's what they did last week. They said, we're going to go in there, and we're going to let him throw the ball, because that's what quarterbacks are supposed to do. So, yeah, I was surprised at 17 straight throws, 18 straight, whatever it was, counting the fumble, all that kind of stuff. But I was not surprised that they were a much more pass-heavy offense and that they specifically attacked the Jets early on, throwing the football to attack the weakness of their defense, which is their secondary.
Overall, though, Sal, when you went back and you looked at those 17 dropbacks, like, talk me through a little bit about what you saw from Josh Allen that you just didn't see in year one, Josh Allen. There was a level of comfortability. The rhythm, Sal, to me, is what I think I left that first half after getting to rewatch it and felt, man, when he's in a rhythm, there's something there, man. There, as a passer, as a nuanced passer, being able to make those short intermediate throws, they looked easy, Sal.
If you go to, you think about last year, one of the stats for Josh Allen last year was he led the league, I believe it was. I got to take a look again what it is, or second in air yards, basically. Mm-hmm. Average yards per attempt. Like, from what I mean is average pass length from him to the target. Okay. He led that last year. In fact, I'm going to look at right now. I have it right here. Last year, he was number one overall, just shy of 11 yards from average from where he is to the target, from the line of scrimmage to the target. That's a lot. Close to 11. After last week, he was only, I'm going to give you the number now, last week, he was only at 8.76. That's the difference, mm-hmm. Nate. The difference is, I'm going to take what's given to me and not have to throw the ball down the field. And the difference is them teaching him and coaching him to take what's given to him and not have to throw the ball down the field. Second half started opening up. The run game started opening up. That opened up the pass game. The thing that I saw from him was, he understood before he snapped it that he's going to have an opportunity to throw the ball short, and he's going to get rid of it, and that's what he did. And then the one play, he tried a little bit too much. He wanted fumbling. Of course, you can't have that. He made a couple critical mistakes. There's no doubt about it. But the biggest thing that I saw, and I think this is something that has been hammered and talked about for months now, which is take the easy money. Take the short throw, and that's what he did. So last year, on average, his average pass went about 11 yards from the line of scrimmage to the target. In this game alone, it was only 8.75 yards, which is a huge discrepancy, by the way. He's middle of the pack in the league in that stat after 1 week, where he led the league in that stat last year.
And I'm fine with that, Sal. Like, that's not a stat that I necessarily want my quarterback leading the league in, only
right.
Because what that indicates is the level of difficulty. You have to be perfect, right? Like, you have to be a very accurate, and to be honest with you, it's just not a stat I'm looking for my quarterback to lead. There are other statistics that I'd be more interested in him leading in than him in his average yards per the yards in which he is the ball is traveling through the air. As you mentioned,
right,
it's kind of hard to explain that. But anyways,
I know, me too.
I
agree with you. Well, look, to your point there, the guy that's usually up near the top is Ryan Fitzpatrick. He led after 1 week, and he was last year's number two guy overall. I mean, there you do have guys. Matt Stafford's up there, Lamar Jackson after last week, and obviously the ridiculous game that he had. But if you take a look at last year's leaders in that category, it goes Allen and then Jameis Winston, Ryan Fitzpatrick. And then you do have Baker Mayfield, Sam Darnold, rookies, guys who are taking shots, right, who also I think have to maybe learn to dial it down a little bit and take what's given to them by the defense, which is weird that Sam Darnold was that high last year. I didn't realize that.
Sam Darnold's that high last year, and then the vast difference we saw in week one. I'm not sure, Sal, if last week, if there was still some lingering side effects of this, of the mono thing that has come out this week of Sam Darnold. He did not look like the Sam Darnold I saw last year, and I don't know if that was a result of the sickness thing or if it's a result of Adam Gase. And if it's a result from Adam Gase, Sal, that's going to be something that I really pay attention to for the rest of the season. That's not why you draft Sam Darnold, is to throw the ball at the line of scrimmage and average 4 yards an attempt. Like that's just not why you draft Sam Darnold.
Yeah, we'll see what happens with that, you know, going forward. But I think that's kind of what Adam Gase's offense might be a little bit, which is, you know, taking the shorter stuff. And then a lot of that has to do with the Bills. I don't know if he was sick when the game was going on, but, you know, we didn't hear anything about that until right afterwards when, you know, he missed practice. But a lot of that has to do with the Bills' defense. And, you know, they'll face a quarterback this week, though, that has an opportunity and has an ability to make bigger plays. And we've seen that. But at the same time, we've seen him and his arm kind of going away a little bit as he gets older here. But he made some plays last week, and he has made some plays over the last few years in Eli Manning. And, you know, it'll be a different test for them. That's for sure.
Sal Capaccio here on the Western Hotline. Sal, let's talk John Brown. What a really great performance. His first as a Bill. Exceeded my expectations of what I expected, only because, Sal, there just wasn't a lot of time, at least game experience, between John Brown and Josh Allen. Were you surprised they looked as in sync as they were, considering there just wasn't a lot of time together?
I don't know. I think they had quite a bit of time together, right? I mean, he was here for all of OTAs and minicamp.
Yeah, I guess there was more time between Allen and John Brown than there was with Allen and Cole Beasley. But
Beasley was out. Brown missed because he had a kid. I mean, he had missed like a week because his wife gave birth.
But considering, like, they looked like they'd been playing together for a long time, and the leading John Brown and just everything that I saw from the two of them, I just kind of walked away thinking, man, it seemed like those two had been playing together for a long time, and he's only been here for a couple months.
Well, right, and, you know, they had a game plan, and I'm sure they worked on the certain routes and the plays and things like that, and, you know, what we don't see even in the media a lot of times is the behind the scenes, the extra work that goes in, you know. And, you know, John Brown was signed a free agent back in March. They show up for first workouts in April. They can start doing football stuff later in April. So you got to think that's pretty much all of May, June, and then into training camp, August, you know, preseason. So I think they've had a little bit more time there, but it's working together. It's working on your craft. It's taking it serious. It's knowing what you want from each other. But let's go back to the first day of training camp. One of the things that really stood out to me was, wow, John Brown isn't just a deep guy. John Brown can get open all over the field. And I said it, other media members said it, like, it was just noticeable in the red zone, especially, that he was, wow, I can't believe this guy who is at that size, who's known to be this just vertical guy, is doing what he's doing and catching the ball everywhere he's catching it. And that's what we saw in week one. They used him in all different ways. I went back and looked at all the different routes he ran. Yeah, they're using him in tons of ways. A lot of ways they like to use him is crossing over the middle and going from one side of the formation to the other, which is where you saw one of the big plays that he made. So it doesn't surprise me, that he's that much in sync with John Brown. I mean, I would hope that, you know, by this point, you know, professionals working on what they're supposed to be working on, that they can do that.
Sal, were you surprised a little bit to see that that Brian Daboll's making fullbacks great again? Did you? I was surprised that I saw 21 personnel as much as I did. What actually surprised me more is they led the league in usage last week, and the second place team was the New England Patriots. So considering the personnel packages that we saw in week one, I don't think there's a trend I'm willing to look at until I see a couple weeks of that usage be that high. But it certainly, in my opinion, helped Josh Allen in his ability to identify what coverages were being run by the New York Jets. And I assume that being a young quarterback with Josh Allen, that we'll see more of those types of things to help him ID the coverage, no?
Well, it's going to be game by game. Uh-huh. So you might see it, you might not this week. You know, they could wind up doing the exact same thing they did last week. They may switch up the personnel packages. I think for most people who are watching the game, it wasn't about because they're not thinking 21 personnel. Most people watching the game are saying, why is Patrick DeMarco on the field so much and why is he split out wide? That's what people notice. And look, the reason is, and you might have already touched on this morning, I don't know, that it when Patrick DeMarco's in the game, Gore or Devin Singletary, suddenly the defense sees, okay, 21, which is two running backs, one tight end, which means two receivers, and they stay in a base package and they keep a linebacker on the field. And then they take Patrick DeMarco and they split him out and that linebacker goes with him. And that tells Josh Allen what coverage they're in. And that takes a linebacker out of the box where they can either pick a matchup to throw it to because it's all one-on-one across the board, or they can run the football, which they didn't do until later. And someone asked me a great point on this and a great question, which is, okay, if that's the case, then why not use TJ Yeldon? Or why not use Frank Gore and split them out? And the reason I would give for you is because the Bills probably realize that if it's Patrick DeMarco, a linebacker's going to go out there with him. But if it's TJ Yeldon, a safety might go out there with him. And therefore, that linebacker stays in the box. So the Bills have to understand how the Jets are going to play him. The Jets have their own personnel that they're going to match up, and it becomes a chess match. And if they do something you don't think they're going to do, then you wind up, you know, switching up. In the one play, Patrick DeMarco almost broke. He was a shoelace away from having a big play down the sidelines when they threw him the ball out there. But you're right. The personnel package, they're trying to keep the other team in base. They're trying to keep the other team to have their linebackers on the field so that Josh Allen can see where those linebackers go when they spread them out, and then he can determine what coverage they're in because of that.
Sal Capaccio here on the West Her Hotline. Sal, before I let you go, I do want to talk a little bit about this Giants team the Bills are going to see this week. Man, they're really shorthanded at the wide receiver position. And, I mean, you got Golden Tate, who's suspended. They lose Sterling Shepard last week to concussion. He's in concussion protocol. Corey Coleman tears his ACL in training camp. They're really, really, really shorthanded at the position. What does that do for the Bills in terms of when they're out there, not having to worry about the passing game as much as they necessarily should on a week-to-week basis, and allows them to focus in on what is probably the best running back in football?
Can I give you a great stat, Nate?
Give it.
All right, so the Bills' three top receivers, I shouldn't say three top receivers, but yards-wise, they have three guys. Frank Gore, by the way, has the most receiving yards of any player in this game. He's been around for so long, right? Frank Gore, John Brown, and Cole Beasley all have over 3,000 receiving yards in their career. Okay, the receivers who are dressing for the Giants combined don't even have 3,000 yards.
Wow. I would be interested in knowing the combined number because I wonder if it gets to 2,000. What is it? Is it like 20?
It's 2,100, 2,500. But here, wait, that's with it's over 2,000 even with Latimer.
Okay.
If Latimer doesn't play, you have to mind. So it's 2,800. Without Latimer, it's 2,100.
Wow.
Because he has 700 something yards. I did it last night.
That's insane.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's who they're going against this week. So the combined yardage, career receiving yards of the New York Giants receivers who are dressing tomorrow, not even 3,000 yards. When the Bills have Frank Gore, John Brown, and Cole Beasley all have over 3,000 yards receiving in their career so far. Pretty amazing stat. This is where the Bills need to win this game. And I don't want them to be reckless, but I would say, I almost want to say, go cover zero. Just cover everybody and put an extra guy up in the box and Saquon Barkley, right? I think the thing you have to watch for in this game, the Giants know this. They know they're undermanned at the wide receiver spot. They're going to try to run the football, and they're going to try and use Saquon Barkley and Evan Ingram in the passing game as much as they can. Those are the two biggest players for them. Saquon Barkley is a fantastic running back. He's going to be tough to stop, whether that's in the run game or the pass game. The Bills need to just be very sure-handed, very sure tackling when they do that. I do not – sure, if you want to press up, go man-to-man, go cover zero, you could always have a ball go over your head for a touchdown. And that stinks right away. Boom. Okay, there it is. But I just think the Bills' DBs match up and should be able to handle these receivers, obviously.
All right, Sal, lastly, it's a matchup that is happening tonight. And a really disappointing a really disappointing matchup last week against Maryland. Everyone sort of knew it was going to be a difficult win for Syracuse. I just don't think that people thought they were going to lose by 40-something points, right? So it was a really disappointing game and performance, especially by the offense, but the defense just they did not look good. This matchup against Clemson, it's at home, it's homecoming. We know how loud it's going to be there. I don't think I'm gonna hear you say that they're gonna win today, but I think that I'm probably gonna hear you say they're gonna play a better game than they did against Maryland, and it should be a close one at the Carrier Dome tonight, right?
I don't know if it'll be close. I think they'll play better, but Clemson is so good they still might lose by 35 points.
Oh, man.
I mean, honestly, like that's where I'm at right now with this. Clemson, the way the defense looked last week, I texted a couple people and said Clemson might hang 100 on us next week. Last week watching that game, and I don't know if that's the case, because I do think, you know, pride has to play a part in this, and it better play a part in this, by the way. You come back home, you have that crowd, you're at homecoming, and I do think there's got to be some part of Syracuse players. They are kids now, let's remember. These are young men who are playing this game. There's a part of them who probably thought, yep, we win this, we got game day coming next week,
right.
Clemson at home, and you do kind of look ahead. And I know that's a little cliche, but I do think it is natural for a young man to do that when they're preparing for a team like Maryland and you have Clemson on the horizon. But, Nate, they didn't play that great against Liberty. Tommy DeVito hasn't played that great in two weeks. I mean, they have to play almost a perfect game to keep it even close. Now, the line is 4 touchdowns. I wouldn't be surprised if Clemson beats that. But I do think Syracuse will play better and show signs of, okay, that's – I think after this game, I'm expecting to say, okay, at least that's the Dino Babers offense I thought I'd see. It's getting a little bit better. But, oh, my God, Clemson's just amazing. And that's why at the end of the game, they tacked on 2 extra scores and they wound up winning 32 to – you know, by 32 points.
Sal, I watched
42 to 10. I don't know.
I watched almost the entire game. And I walked away, and I did not think that I would walk away from this or any Syracuse game this year and say, wow, Eric Dungy played a much, much larger role in that offense than I...
Absolutely.
He was so important to them.
100%.
And I just didn't give him that credit, only because it's like, listen, he wasn't a great thrower of the football. He ran the ball a lot. He had injury issues because of that. But, man, you could the presence that is no longer there, I thought Tommy DeVito was ready. And maybe he, at the end of the year, I think maybe me and you will have a conversation saying, this is the player I thought we were going to get at the beginning of the year, but he's still young. But, man, they miss Eric Dungy.
100% they do. I had a funny video, if you see it on Twitter or not, with Shaq Lawson in the locker room yesterday. I just had fun with him. I'm like, Shaq, what's going on? You know, what's going to happen tomorrow at the game? And Shaq said, you know, the difference is, he goes, Dungy was there for 6 years. I laughed. I'm like, it seemed like it, right? But he had so much respect for Eric Dungy. And I think that's, you're right, 100%, that, you know, Eric Dungy was the difference for this team for the last few years. And DeVito's just not there yet. And I don't know if he ever will be. I hope he will be. He had a very highly recruited quarterback, not, you know, amongst the top in the country, but a very well-recruited quarterback, one of the guys that Syracuse, kind of the guy that Syracuse usually doesn't get at the position, but they wound up getting. And, you know, we'll see. I hope he plays better. I just think that Clemson is just so tough. I will say this, though. I mean, when you have a team like that, maybe there's a formula that Dino and his coaching staff knows about Clemson that, you know, they've just kind of figured out over the last couple of years. So you never know with that. But boy, they have so much there. It'll be fun seeing the Carrier Dome, you know, packed and loud and all that.
That'll
be really cool. And I think it's the primetime game. Herb Street will be there, and they'll be doing that game. I'll be in New York. We'll be at a Syracuse Backers bar watching it. So at least having some fun and eating, whether or not having fun watching the game or not.
That's another story, right, Sal? All right, buddy. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. You and I will be talking on pregame in the morning, halftime, you know, the whole day. So enjoy.
All right, have a great show. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Sal. Sal Capaccio there on the West Her Hotline. Got to take a quick break. When we come back, Mike Catalana of Fox Rochester, 13 Wham, is going to join us. We're going to talk a little bit about Josh Allen, this Bills offense, as well as they face off against the New York Giants here next on Sports Talk Saturday on WGR.
I feel like we just got to do what we do and just play the cards that we play and don't try to play hero ball, just do our job and do our fundamentals and stay over the top of those guys, and I feel like we'll be fine no matter who's in there.
Tre'Davious White of the Buffalo Bills there, Nate Geary here, Derek Kramer over there, and Mike Catalana here as well on the West Her Hotline. Mike, good to talk to you, my friend. It's been too long, since like the summer or something, but either way, happy to have you on. Thanks for making some time for me.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
So, Mike, you did a piece, and I read it this morning, and I found myself like kind of just nodding in agreement. Basically, your point was, and if anyone else didn't read it, of course, you can go to, you could follow Mike on Twitter, and he's got it up there, post it at Mike Catalana. And you talked a little bit about Josh Allen's role, right?
Yep.
And not wanting him to feel as much as it's maybe the most overused NFL/football term ever is you just do your 111th, right? And that's especially, right. That's a McDermottism if I've ever heard of it. But your point is he's not one of those and he can't be. And your franchise quarterback a lot of the times isn't that player. And I think the Bills have been so used to not having a franchise player that it's just okay to say, hey, he's got to do his 111th and we'll be okay. Tell us a little bit about why you feel he's not or he can't be that player and he needs to sort of transcend that idea.
Well, I think there's two parts to look at it. Number one, there's his ability on the field. And I think, you know, he comes in as a young guy. And I think there's one thing that's been a little understated about Josh. I think he's done a phenomenal job of accepting his role, his place on the team, while remaining the guy who doesn't act like I got it all figured out. Because he doesn't have it all figured out yet. He's still a young player. He has been a leader, but hasn't tried to be... He's been one of the guys. He doesn't have to be the guy. Okay, he knew last year it was still, you know, Kyle Williams' team, LeSean McCoy's team, you know, Lorenzo Alexander, name the guy. But you are the quarterback. So when the head coach constantly would say, and understandably so, just do your job, 111, I get that. But when I talk about him being 111, one, he has to accept the fact that those players now look at him as the guy. I mean, last weekend when we're in the locker room after the game, when you hear the players talk about the faith they had in him, I've heard lip service many years of covering this team when they don't really believe in the guy, but they tell you that anyhow. And then I listen to guys talk about him, and I think, hey, Josh, you got to realize they do believe in you as the guy. So in terms of him saying, I'm not 111th, I know he is naturally – I mean, you got to have confidence to play in this league. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he's arrogant to that point of thinking, okay, I got it figured out. But you have to start accepting the fact that those players look at you that way as more than just a guy, more than just a next man up when the other guy's got to play. Sure, if Matt Barkley had to play, they'd support him, but they realize he's different. And then the other part is you're not 111th because you've got to protect yourself on the field. And I think there's a part, an adjustment, where a guy realizes, I am not just a regular player on the team. I've got to stay healthy, stay on the field to help my team. And not only do I feel that way, but the other guys on the team feel that way. And I think, you know, as a second-year guy, he's got to accept the fact that those eyes are on him, that those guys believe their future and their paycheck to some extent.
I think we might be losing Mike there. Let's see if do we got him back, Derek?
Make is that he's taking too many hits on the field. He needs to realize, I'm sorry, Josh, you're not just 111. You got to stay on the field, and you got to be a little smarter out there on the field.
Mike Catalana here on the West Her Hotline. Mike, one of the interesting things that has been a development to me anyways, is the level of faith and trust that Brian Daboll has essentially empowered Josh Allen, not only at the line of scrimmage, to be a player that can put his offense into the best possible play. He's given Josh Allen ample amount of time pre-snap to make those decisions. And one of the things that Sal Capaccio and I were just talking about last segment is the I don't want to say it's a development, but their usage of a Pat DeMarco, of a fullback in this offense, in giving Josh Allen plenty of time pre-snap to make the right decision and put them in the best possible play. Are you surprised that Josh Allen has as much say in this offense at the line of scrimmage as he does being, you know, last week was his 12th career start?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I think that's a natural progression. I'm a little surprised that this coaching staff has seen that in him, and I give Brian Daboll a lot of credit for that because I think he's saying, look, we're going to ride you here, so we need you to do that. And I think it's a very difficult position to play if you can't figure stuff out pre-snap. And I think DeMarco became sort of a cheat sheet for him. Like, you put the fullback out there, and the purpose is, at least as far as I see in it, the purpose is to identify what kind of coverage the defense is going to be in. It gives him a little bit of help in terms of doing that. I don't think they really believe DeMarco is going to catch a lot of balls, but I think it helps Allen in that. I don't think he's always going to need Pat DeMarco to help him in that way, but I do think it's progress, and it's great to see him step out there on the field and start to see things at least somewhat before they happen. If you want to be better in this league, you got to do that. And I'm slightly surprised, but I'm encouraged because I think the coaching staff sees it in him and they see he can handle it.
Mike Catalano here on the West Her Hotline. So 17 straight dropbacks to start the game. We're talking about things that surprise you, but I have to imagine that that surprised you a little bit, that they come out, they throw 17 straight times, and they do it rather effectively. And I mentioned this to Sale. You know, it's hard for Sale and I. Sale's on the sideline. You don't get to see the broadcast footage until after the game. Here in studio, it's really hard for me to really focus in on the things that I want to focus in on when I'm watching the game. But I went back, and after watching it back a few times, I was actually not only surprised at the frequency in which they threw early in that football game, but, Mike, the frequency and the effectiveness to me together was an interesting. Now, of course, they end up turning the ball over a few times, but yep. I don't think that that was a result or because of the fact that they were so aggressive throwing the football. I just think that there were some fluky turnovers, and I really like the way that this team looks because they look modern to me, Mike.
Totally agree. And I thought, you know, there's the old line, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? Like, other than the turnovers, they looked like a 2019
yes.
NFL offense. And it's so funny, Nate. I really like Devin Singletary as a player, and I like the type of back that he is. And look, Thurman Thomas is one of the all-time greats. And I've joked about it or just talked a little bit about the way Singletary moves on the field reminds me a little bit of Thurman. And then I went back, and the first game I covered for the Bills was Thurman Thomas. And I appreciate everything Thurman did. And I was looking back at some old Thurman highlights, and I just realized it's almost sacrilegious to say anybody is like Thurman. But when I went back and looked at it, what struck me is how the Bills' 1990 offense looked more like a 2019 offense than the Bills have looked for the last few years. Like back then, the movement, the spread, the pace, and then I would see what they've been running the last few years, and it's so dated. Sunday, they looked much more like a 2019 NFL offense. And I'm hoping that's just the beginning of what we're going to see out of them.
Yeah, and Mike, the one thing that I'm going to continue to take away each week is the role that Brian Daboll's playing in this, right? And I think that for the most part, one of the things that was talked about when Brian Daboll came here was, okay, yeah, like this is a guy who was with the Patriots. I get it. Like, but otherwise, wasn't a guy that had, you know, crazy amounts of success as an offensive coordinator.
Yeah.
And even in college in Alabama with his 1 year, you're like, okay, well, who did they play? That offense, you could have, you know, I could call plays for the Alabama offense and likely have success. So at the same time, though, year one, Brian Daboll, in year two, he's got weapons in his chest now. Like he's got things now that NFL teams have. Or last year, you know, you're rolling out Andre Holmes. And no offense to, you know, the Thomases and the Andre Holmes and the Kelvin Benjamins of the world, but these aren't modern day NFL players that you can surround a young quarterback or a young offense in. Are you excited about the transition that we've seen from year one to year two to Brian Daboll? And I guess my second half of that question is, are you a little worried? Because if Brian Daboll has any level of significant success this season with Josh Allen, he's going to have opportunities to be a head coach in this league just because the NFL is going towards offensive head coaches more and more every day.
Well, to the second part first, yes, that's always a concern. And I think that's why a lot of teams like their head coach to be an offensive guy, because they figure they're always going to have him tied to the quarterback, right? If the head coach, McVay, Peterson, whoever it is, tied with their quarterback. And I make the analogy that a head coach has to be like a dad walking his daughter down the aisle when he turns the quarterback over to an offensive coordinator, because so much control over something so precious goes to another person. And that's what he's going to have to live with. Look, wouldn't it be great if the Bills lose a guy because they've had so much success in that sense? I guess they'll have to deal with that when it happens. But to the other point about Daboll, I think he had one of the most unique starts with an organization I've ever seen. One of the worst offensive lines I've ever seen, one of the worst wide receiving cores. You start the season handling the quarterback situation maybe as poorly as I've ever seen it done, where you're down to Nate Peterman and a rookie, And then your coordinator then has to work with this, get the rookie started week two, bring in guys off the retirement home at quarterback, get him acclimated to the offense, bring in another quarterback, get him acclimated to the offense, and all this while moving a rookie quarterback along. Look at the difference between the last offseason and this offseason for Brian Daboll. He had to deal with so much that was really out of his control last year that I think this will be the first time we actually see what he can do with competent players in those positions and stability at the quarterback spot.
Mike, lastly, when we look at the opponent this week, Eli Manning, I think is that franchise, considering the success that they had in Eli Manning's prime, have just done such a poor job of sending him out on top. And not that I think the franchise owes Eli Manning anything. I do think there's a level of, it's kind of a shame, right? That a once great player that beat the maybe greatest player of all time in one of the more iconic Super Bowl victories, going up against a 16-0 team. Let's just, everything that went into Eli Manning's success over his career, I think it is kind of a shame the way that he's unfortunately going to go out. And I think it's really only a matter of time before Daniel Jones is either named the starter or just takes it due to lack of ability and from the stance of Eli Manning. But man, who is he going to throw to this week? It's a shame that, you know, Dave Gettleman has done what he's done to this roster, because it's going to have a lot of ill will towards Eli Manning and just through the eyes of Giants fans. And a lot of people forget how good Eli Manning was in his prime.
Yeah, and they handled the first pushing out of Eli so poorly that it's almost like they can't do it poorly again, or they don't want to. I mean, seriously, when you're ready to bench Eli, you just take him out. You don't offer him to start and
right.
Sit. I mean, they just handled that so poorly. And there's a point where, much like the way he started his career with the Giants, Kurt Warner's the guy, and they're 5-4, but at that point they decided to go with him. And that was probably the right move long-term for the franchise. They've handled this so poorly. Yeah, you're right. Jones is going to play. But to the point of not having anybody to go with, it's the whole, like, Saquon Barkley is as good as there is at running back in the NFL, and they're going to have one of the worst offenses in the NFL. Mm-hmm. You can have a very good running back, and that's great, but if you don't have the quarterback and you don't have guys that can go get the ball, it's just too difficult to play offense, as we've seen from the Buffalo Bills when McCoy was a little closer to his prime. You need the quarterback play. They've handled it poorly. I keep wondering, like, could they bench him in the second half of this game? How well does he have to play to stay on the field? At what point do they pull the plug and go with the kid? It's got to happen relatively soon, because you're going to want to see him play, and it's going to end poorly for Eli. But to your point about pass catchers, it looks like last year's Bills. I mean, I know Ingram is a nice tight end, but come on. I mean, they have Barkley and not much else around him. And so you have to look at it and say, not only bad for Eli, but what is Daniel Jones walking into right. when he starts with no weapons? So Gettleman has handled it poorly. They've got a lot of work to do, and I would not be stunned if it happens relatively soon. It would be something if it happens. You know, when we see it happen the next time when Eli comes out of the game, I think the next time it happens, it's the last time he comes out of the game.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And as you mentioned, it is just a shame how poorly they managed it last year and then brought him back. Like, it's to me, was always the puzzling part of this. And was he going to go start someplace? I mean, probably not. But, you know, there was always that inkling that it could be Jacksonville. They end up getting Foles. Like, he's not going to start right. somewhere else. But what happened last year with how poorly things ended there, I thought for sure that was going to be the end of Eli. And then he's back. And now it's going to be sort of this week-by-week thing. And I just think, as much as he's not this, like, he's not a polarizing player. He never has been. In fact, he's been probably one of the most boring superstars. And yes, he is a Hall of Famer. And, like, it's crazy to me that people are like, Eli Manning's not a Hall. Listen, you win two Super Bowls. You go out and you beat Tom Brady in one of them in a year that he went undefeated in the best season. Like, he's going to go to the Hall of Fame. He's probably not a first ballot guy, but like how that franchise has bungled that situation, it's to me is almost unforgivable.
and there's no reason for it. If they were doing what they did last year with Daniel Jones on the roster,
that's
and
one
Jones
thing.
Jones was going to be the starter,
right?
It would have made sense. I mean, of all people, really, it ended up being Geno Smith. I mean, that they're looking at. Like, I mean, you couldn't have handled that more poorly than they did. And this is 2 weeks in a row that the Bills are going up against franchises that have less of a plan and less stability. And I guess that's all progress, because the Bills are starting to look like a franchise who actually has a plan. Josh Allen. Josh Allen is a huge part of that, and that's why he's got to handle himself that way. But they look like an organization that's on the same page. And when you see people like the Jets and you see people like the Giants, it's nice to have a little stability in the franchise that you follow.
I will say that. That is for sure, Mike. And it's a refreshing change of pace, to say the least. Well, I appreciate you making some time this morning, this afternoon for me, Mike. Enjoy the game tomorrow and enjoy the weekend. And we'll be talking soon as the season moves on.
All right, Nate, thanks very much.
Yep, Mike Catalana there on the Western Hotline. Of course, you can follow Mike at Mike Catalana on Twitter. Works for Fox Rochester and 13 Wham TV. He's a sports director over there. Quick time out. When we come back, we'll set up our hour three interview, and we will have Scott Wilson. He's the color guy on ESPN 1520 for the UB Bulls, so we'll talk to him. I'm interested in his take, maybe more than anyone, because he's closest to the college football game than anybody about some of the paying of college athletes. So we'll talk a little bit about that, talk about UB's matchup against Liberty today, and we'll also take any of your phone calls, 803-0551, 888-552-550. Sports Talk Saturday, rolling along here on WGR. Hey, y'all. Nate Geary here. Derek Kramer. We've got a minute or two before we got to go to a break again. Actually, probably a little bit late to break anyways, but me? Never. We were talking about during the break the Mitch Marner situation. I thought it was an interesting one just to kind of brush on real quick. And
way to go, Paul.
And kind of our thought process that Mitch Marner signs yesterday a fairly significant, what did the term end year end up being? Provorov's, that's right, he re-signed yesterday to a six-year deal. What was the Marner numbers? It was 7 years?
Marner numbers, 6 years.
6 years.
And it's a 10.89
Yeah, so just under cap hit per just year. Under 11. They're basically, if you combine the average of their top three, which is Marner, Matthews, and Tavares, they're basically averaging out $11 million for three players. So, and not only that, but you have Nylander at what, 7.5, I think, right? Some of them are along there. So, yeah, I mean, they've got 65-70% of their entire salary cap dedicated to four players. I think the logical thing is Nylander likely won't be on that roster by the end of the season. By the start of next season, I guess I should say. They're not going to trade him this year, I don't think. But, yeah, I mean, how that plays out in Toronto is interesting. And we mentioned they've got two UFA defensemen that they really like in Jake Muzzin and Barry that are going to be UFAs next year. And they're going to have to pay one or both of them if they want to continue to be a good hockey team. So,
matter of fact, their entire defensive core
is UFAs.
Are free agents. Are wow. Free agents. Ben Harper and Jordan Schmaltz are RFAs after the season. Same with Rasmus Sandin. But there's a lot of questions you're going to have to do here. Like, you're hoping basically that Sandin and Timothy Liljegren are ready to go.
Not only that, they
at 19 and 20.
They really, to me, $11 million per three players. Like, they didn't get anything that Brandon Shanahan said, right? Like, Shanahan, Dubas, like, all these guys said, yeah, these guys are going to take hometown discounts. Not one of them has. Not one has taken a hometown discount.
So, in addition, though, to Matthews, Tavares, Marner, Nylander, you have three more years of Morgan Rielly at $5 million per season, the only defenseman you have signed past next year.
That's insane, yeah.
Alex Kerfoot has 4 years left on a deal, 3.5. You better bet that's going to be the next man out. And then Andreas Janssen might even get traded at $3.4 million over the next 4 years. Their cap situation is very top-heavy.
It's top-heavy, and we mentioned that they got one good value contract out of that, Kapanen, this offseason, signed for a pretty low term.
That's 3.2 still.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's actually more than I thought it was. Yeah, I mean, they're going to have a tough time. There's just no doubt
Basically,
about it.
Basically, this is... you put up or shut up with this team this year, because if you don't, you've got some problems. Freddie Anderson next year is making $5 million, and that'll be his age 31 season. there's a lot going on here. I feel like the Leafs, they need to finally get themselves out of the first round in order to validate any of this.
And if they don't, man, it's gonna get ugly in Toronto. All right, quick timeout. When we come back, I've got Scott Wilson. Scott is the color analyst for the UB football team. He's gonna join us here at 1 p.m. Going to talk UB Liberty this afternoon, or this evening, I should say, 6:30 kick there. The Bulls are on the road, so we'll talk to Scott a little bit about that, a little bit about some college football in general. So we'll do that next here on Sports Talk Saturday, rolling along on WGR.